Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today we're talking to David Gillis about projects and doing meaningful work after retiring. David, how's it going today?
It's great, Doug. Thanks for having me. I'm really enjoying the free time and doing what I like. So yeah, thanks. I'm excited for the conversation.
All right. Yeah. And I wanted to invite you on because as I talk to people that are nearing retirement, have retired, or maybe they retired and then thought it didn't work out and they've gone back to work, like their old corporate job in some cases, it's apparent and it's very obvious that people are looking for, you know, something meaningful. Maybe their identity was tied up in their previous job, especially if they've worked hard and accomplished a lot, and maybe they have, again, a bit of their identity tied up with their actual position. So when they leave that, they're kind of searching around and they don't have the same fulfillment that they did before with the job where it was kind of laid out clearly, maybe even with objectives, and you can get raises and bonuses and stuff all associated with that meaningful purpose in the work. So we're going to dig into some of the details here. Now, you have gone to many different conferences. You spoke at several, and there are obviously a lot of the audience, they haven't met you yet. So David, can you give a little intro, who you are, what do you do now, maybe a little bit of your history from a professional standpoint, and then we'll dig into some of these other details.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Doug. So I'm from Kentucky, joined the Air Force. I spent a career moving around the country doing different things in the Air Force and retired in 2014. And from that point, I moved over and I started running a contract to teach military members how to improve performance by, like, say, your communication, your decision-making. So I did that about 10 years or so. And then last year, the contract wasn't renewed. And that was a perfect timing anyway. And decided to see what I can do to help others and do what I can. I've been money coaching for a while, and I've been a TEDx speaker coach for about 6 years now, helping people with amazing stories and ideas worth spreading. And so I wanted to combine all that together into, I have a conference that I ran in February, and I'll do one again in August. And so I just love helping others, helping people together and create that community. So that's what I've been doing the last year or so, kind of testing out this financial independence and the step toward freedom.
Okay. When did you get into personal finance and start along the track of, like, early retirement?
It was about 2014, 2015. So when early retirement was being offered up, and it was something that it was kind of a short notice thing for the Air Force, and then we were not prepared at all at that point. We still had thousands, a ton of debt at that point, and we were struggling, and the transition was difficult. And so from that point, moving away from that, I found Dave Ramsey, like a lot of people do, get out of debt, and then kind of want to move on from that to other things for investing purposes. So, and then I started taking over the Choose FI, the local group. That's when they were starting up, and then started meeting people that were interested in financial independence and creating the life that they want today. It's just an amazing community. So that 2014, 15 transitioned to 2018 or so, and I've gotten to with financial independence, kind of searching for that. And today I don't know what the label is on it now, but I think we're either financially independent or at least Coast Fi, but probably. We're seeing how we are testing out the waters here without having to have a full-time W-2 job.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, it's kind of fuzzy in the lines, especially we have the different definitions of FI, and maybe you earn a little bit of money, or has your wife also stopped working?
No, she's still working. We're kind of testing out another couple of years. Okay. Kind of transitioning out and maybe have her do some things from home. Plan is for another 2 more years for her.
Okay. Yep. And then at that point, it's like a little fuzzy. It's like, one person is like stepping back because you guys can meet your cash flow needs conceivably from her income and maybe still save a little bit. So yeah, it's real fuzzy, but you're at a point where you're like, I'm going to try this passion project and see how it goes. And that's a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about today. So I am curious because I didn't come from the Ramsey camp. I came into the Phi stuff kind of sideways anyhow. But a lot of people cut their teeth on the Ramsey maybe curriculum and just some of the ideas and books and other stuff. And then they graduate to something more advanced where they're like, okay, I think there's probably a little bit more to it. Maybe we can use credit cards or maybe certain debt is okay kind of thing, right? What are some of the big things that you got out of Ramsey's programs or teachings in some capacity? What was the most valuable that helped you guys out?
Probably two things. The first is the intense push to get out of debt, to kind of control your finances, control those expenses. And then two was just kind of the prioritize. He has the baby steps process. I think just organizing things, having the end goal, the financial independence, and then figuring out, okay, what's our priority right now? The baby steps, what's something we can do today? And I think that's where we modified some, and we definitely use credit cards, and we've diverted from it. And I think we've flown about 80 free flights in the last 8 years. Whoa. And just we travel a lot to visit family all over the country or travel. So we definitely diverge somewhat. But yeah, I think the priority system, I think that's a good thing. Figure out what you want to do and the order of it and the debt reduction.
And then before that, you said you had, you know, thousands in debt. Was it like credit card debt, other consumer kind of debt? What details? Just curious how you were spending.
Yeah, we had everything. We had a lot of credit card debt still at that time. We had a couple of car payments. We had still had a student loan from my wife. We just had it was overwhelming, and we were just kind of barely chipping away at it for a while. Yeah, it was a struggle. So we had a lot of debt. So just getting out of that, just so like a weight lifted. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long did it take to get out?
I would say once we really got kind of intense and pushing to get out of it, it was maybe 2 years or so.
Okay.
To kind of push through and get rid of it. My wife had even said that she didn't even think at that point that she thought she'd have her student loans for her whole life or until retirement. So that was just a perspective many people have, that you're going to have that forever.
One observation, you know, with your military background, and we've talked before, so you have a strategic mind, you're smart, you know how to prioritize stuff. The observation is how interesting it is that we have blind spots for our own situation. So conceivably, you saw the debt you had, and you know how to prioritize, and you can see maybe different interest rates or the smallest balance or however you want to tackle your debt. And you have the money coming in and you have your expenses. It's not really that complicated, but it is interesting that we can't see the solution to our own problem. But I'm sure you could, even at that time, you probably could have helped a friend or family member that was in the same situation and unravel it for them. Do you have any thoughts on that? Just blind spots in our own situation that we can't see?
I mean, I think automation is a great thing and a terrible thing. Like if you can automate, say, your habits, and having those good habits help things out and help you have the expectation. Like there's a boxing gym I used to go to, and then the expectation was I was going to go, and worst case, I wasn't going to go. And then when that gym closed, it threw me for a loop and threw out my habits, and I didn't know what to do, and so I'm still kind of struggling to figure out my habits in that instance. But I mean, automation from those monthly expenses that we never use to streaming services, et cetera. I mean, the marketing gurus, I mean, their job is to grab that money and make you not think about it. And I think just we can do, like, there's so many different things that they're pulling our money away from us. And it was what Paul Pant says, you can afford anything, but not everything. I think that's this instance that we can think, I can do this and I can do that, but putting them all together, I think that becomes overwhelming. And it just takes time and forethought and relationship building to make sure that you're all on the same page.
So 2024, you retired, right? So you were maybe 1099, you had some contract going on. Is that roughly accurate or?
So the summer of 2025, like last summer, so it's almost been a year or so.
Okay. So the contract wasn't being renewed. You were like, cool. we've been focusing on our finances for a decade, probably for the last 5+ years. You have been looking at early retirement and actually like getting pretty far ahead. And this opportunity popped up. Was it an obvious choice for you? You were like, yes, I'm going to give this a try. Did you have to think about it and, you know, weigh the pros and cons? How did you face that decision?
There's a lot of good conversations with my wife, kind of figuring out the next steps. And it was something to kind of think through. And it was more of a testing thing that we wanted to do, test it out, see how we do, see how the expenses are, see how the net worth or investments are doing after a while, kind of test it out for about a year. And I would say we're better off now than we were when we retired, even without my full W-2 income. So I think that's something to think through. It's not always just a light switch. It's not always on and off. It can be dim, up and down. And let's try a little bit here, see how it works, and maybe add a little bit. So you might get paid something for doing something and might step back when you want to have more control and more travel.
Did you find yourself bored after you stopped working? Did you seek other jobs or anything like that? How did it go the first little bit of time?
For a little bit, I did some little bit of part-time work on the base to kind of keep my security clearance active and kind of testing it out a little bit to see what our expenses were going to be needed or see what how much money we were going to need. So I kind of tested some stuff out for a while and then just didn't really enjoy that. And kind of actually getting that first conference in February, that was kind of the more beta run, kind of run of the course to see that it actually works. And I think that's something that I wanted to keep doing and kind of lit the fire of kind of pushing toward what I want to do. And I've really been doing this for about 10 years, kind of laying the groundwork for it. I was a kid growing up that didn't talk on the bus, to be able to work on my communication. I think that was one of the things when I retired from the Air Force that I felt like my communication skills were lacking and I wanted to work on that. And just being a quieter guy in general, I think that was a struggle, not be able to kind of market myself or kind of be my own advocate as well as I could have been. So I joined a bunch of Toastmaster clubs, which are speech clubs, and joined at 3 at the time to the financial independence discussion and then teaching classes, like 8,000 some people in the last 10 years. It's kind of helping them improve performance. That helped me to kind of feel through what I like to do. But then testing new things, like I did some improv comedy classes and graduated from that program after about 14 months. And just being around different people, I think, helped me open up my mind to different things. And then that led me to teaching a class with some of the TEDx local directors. And she was in the class and asked me to come help her. So then I volunteered with them. I've been doing that for about 6 years now as a speaker coach. And I think that's just surreal to me, being that kid on the bus that didn't talk and the anxiety to be able to help people get on that red circle and get on the stage and kind of spread their message and their ideas worth spreading. I think everybody needs to kind of find their own path but have a community of people that kind of build them up and help them. And financial independence communities and the TEDx communities, those two things together are just very open communities of helping people, very curious, creative, critical thinkers, and very kind. I think that's what life's about being there for others and helping people.
I want to go back to a couple things that you mentioned. So Toastmasters, tell people what a typical meeting is like, and I'll buy you some time here. I went to only a couple meetings in preparation for a talk that never happened. So I was invited to do a talk. It was at a Google campus. It was like a Google related thing. It was a different company, but I was like, I'm going to speak at Google. This is crazy. They're flying me up all this. I was like, all right, I need to prepare. I haven't done many talks. It was March of 2020. So the whole thing got canceled, but I went to a couple meetings and I was so nervous just sitting. I mean, it was only like 10, 15 people, something like that, but so nervous just the early meetings that I went to, but very helpful. So let people know what a sort of typical Toastmasters meeting maybe looks like. I know there may be different themes, but lay it out for us.
Overall, it's about developing your communication skills and your leadership skills. So you'll run the meeting, you'll say you'll be the toastmaster of the day, will be the one that gavel in the meeting and kind of organize and keep it on schedule. You have planned speeches, and then you have kind of impromptu speeches called table topics, where people will just give you a question and you stand up and you answer the question within 1 to 2 minutes. I think just having a variety of, let's say, areas to work on, I think just allows you the ability to try and do what you want to do and what you need to do. I've practiced my talks from the different events and things I've done to my impromptu speaking. And I think I always felt my conversation skills were lacking sometimes. And it's just, I was kind of a very, very methodical, slow thinker, and just people had this quick conversation and I'd be like, I've got something to say about topic number two before you bounce to number seven. So I think it's about kind of organizing your mind and practicing. That's what life's about, is just repetition, practicing, embracing failure, and then getting good evaluations from others or giving evaluations. I think you're going to see what works and what doesn't. So it's always about the audience and about others. And we get so lost in our own head, you don't think about, okay, did they get out of it what they need? Am I giving value? And that's what I've been working on, from TEDx speaker to coach to Toastmasters to whatever I do, is do I give value to others? And that's what life should be about.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah. And I would say, if people haven't checked out a Toastmasters meeting, especially if you're like earlier in your career, like I wish I would have gone in my 20s, because it made me a lot more confident in a very short amount of time. I think I only went to maybe 2 or 3 meetings in person before it moved to online. So we were doing Zoom meetings, which I had plenty of experience talking to a camera by myself. So that wasn't nearly as helpful as the nerves that you get when you stand in front of a group and someone is counting how many filler words you use and that sort of thing. Sounds stressful, but it's extremely helpful to have someone come back and say, you used 47 filler words and you really need to work on that. But you clean it up immediately. Like within the next week, you start listening much more closely. So highly recommended. And I assume you also recommend, like, Toastmasters kicks ass completely, right?
It does. I've been still a part of it. I've got a club that I'm still with that. At that point, I joined 3 clubs. It was like a local club and then 2 advanced clubs that I saw that they had very senior people in that, those other clubs. So it was just, I think it's about repetition. It's about practice. It's about having good mentors. It's about trying new things and realizing, even no matter who gives you advice, even somebody that's got 30 more years of experience than you, they don't always know exactly what you're going through. So it's always coming from their perspective. So that's really helped me develop my skills, and I'm still working on it. It's still a constant thing. It's not a yes or no. It's something that I'm still working on, but I think it's so valuable in life to communicate with others, because that's really where we get that connection with people. It's about communicating effectively and listening skills and being able to speak your truth.
And I chatted with a couple people over the years. There's so many meetings with maybe different emphasis, and different members have obviously different personalities, so the group comes together a little differently. But I had a friend or two that would go to a meeting every single day because there were so many around. And I was like, holy crap, that is really insane. But they made huge strides. And again, like, you're getting feedback from so many different people. So I can't say enough about it. And I only went to a handful of meetings over time. There were a couple actors and comedians in the group that I went to. And that's something, I love stand-up comedy and I appreciate laughing very much. So I want to talk about the improv class. So another way to get out of your shell, and it sounds like you were doing it for a pretty decent chunk of time. So what drove you to enroll, and what are some things you learned?
Let's see. So I did it for about, say, 14 months, and it's like it's 5 classes for graduation. What drove me to join it? I love comedy. I really enjoy, like, humor and saying funny things. I've always been one to kind of step in, drop a one-liner, a bomb, and step back and see the reaction. And And I wanted to do that plus more. And people didn't always recognize my dry humor, and I wasn't very good about my timing, et cetera, sometimes. So I think I don't know if it was one of those discounted ones initially that my wife got me. I can't even remember the initial one. And because I've always thought that it would be interesting to do something like that, or Saturday Night Live, et cetera. But it's just such an amazing community of people, and it still is. And that's why I even have improv workshops at my conferences. I've got some people that come in and do some different workshops to try new things, because I believe in the value of it. And it's about putting yourself in new situations and trying something that's a little bit outside your comfort zone. And they say that if you're comfortable, then you're kind of receding back into your bubble, and you're not growing. And I think that's just an amazing community of people, where like level one class is everybody's brand new to it, and nobody has any background at all when you go to a level one improv class. And that just sets the bar just at a low level, which is perfect for people that just, if you can just step into the circle and say something and then step back, I think that's all that matters, is about kind of trying new things. I mean, the famous line from them is the yes and. It's about building on other people's stories and not shutting them down and saying, no, you're not doing that, or no, we can't do that. I mean, that's what a lot of life's about. People like shut you down and say, no, we can't do that because their confidence is low, or they've been hit down by other situations in the past. But it's something like that. Is like, I really embrace the yes and, of like, okay, what can we do to build a better place and build a better life and better community? And communication about kindness. I think that's what that and empathy is so important to life, about understanding where people are and where they're coming from. And that's, I think there's so many different things I learned from improv about stepping up and taking initiative, about supporting others. And it's about having fun, not trying to be funny, not forcing things, but just go and enjoy yourself and just try to make each other laugh. Don't worry about the audience. And I would say I was okay at it. Nothing. I mean, I think it's great days and things that don't always work, but that's what life's about. If you're always winning, then you're not setting the bar high enough.
I haven't taken any comedy classes or improv or anything like that. It sounds scary to me, actually, which is probably a sign I should maybe give it a shot. But that's me. We're not here to talk about my problems. So, and I get you, though, with a dry sense of humor. You're a good straight man. Like, you could come in and, like, you serve that, like a Leslie Nielsen type, right? Yeah. It's like, is this even a joke? And then he goes on a little further and then hits you with one of the strong punchlines. All right. So, you did some work, tried some part-time stuff. You took some of these classes. You were working on speaking over the years and stuff like that. And as you mentioned, like, all this stuff was kind of coming together for the 1% Better conference. Maybe you just didn't know it at the time. So you had some free time and you were thinking, I kind of want to do this conference. What were some of the first steps? I mean, it's a huge thing to put together. You have to have speakers. You have to have a venue. There's food. You have to sell tickets and market and tell people why they should be there. So how did you approach it from the very beginning? And when did it start also? So you could just kind of tell us the story, the origin story of the conference.
I've been thinking about doing something like that for a few years, 2 or 3 years. I think just going to like Camp Fies, the FenCon or Economy. I mean, there's some great events, great people. And then that combined with the TEDx type of things I've been doing the last 6 years, about all these amazing speakers that I knew. I love creating a community of people and about helping people spread their own message too. So I knew a lot of speakers through TEDx, through financial independence, through the military, and I think that all came together. I started talking with some different people about it, and really it's about, I asked the people that created those other conferences, or Kim from the Women of Phi to the Diana from Economy to Stephen from Camp Phi, just all these people that have done these events, and saying, okay, what didn't work for you? What advice would you have for somebody that's doing something like this? And so I got a lot of different advice from different perspectives. And I really enjoyed the smaller like Camp Phi type sized events. I think we got more intimate. And it just kind of pulled together into a combination of those, the TEDx and the financial independence communities. And the speaker wise, it hasn't been that difficult at all. I know a lot of different people that it's about finding the right speakers, about finding the different topics, about not doing the same thing over and over again. It's about keeping it interactive. And I think that's being, I've been teaching, I think, like 8,000 people in the last 10 years, the smaller classes, like 20 people or less type of classes to the military. And that really helped me with my facilitation skills and about helping people talk about difficult situations. Or if you ask anybody, like, what frustrates you? I think it's something that'll come to their mind. And then, like, okay, you can twist it and say, okay, now what can we do about that? Is there something we can do? Or is it just acknowledging it? And then now we can move on because we've acknowledged it. Or just all those things led to the want to do something like that. How do I put it together? My wife's amazing, and she does a lot of things that I can't do. She's a marketing background, graphic design to the website. So I started putting some different things in place, and then asked for people the advice and see who I could get to talk. And it came together great in February. I think just having that with 32, 35 people, something like that at the conference, which is a great number of people to keep it intimate and interactive too. Because I think everybody takes away stuff, what they need from something. And I think that's what we wanted to give, from improv workshops to communication exercises to Joe Salcihi came in and did a talk on and just amazing thought about what you would do if you only had a little bit of time left. And then why aren't you doing that now? I think that so many from amazing people that came together to help me with that. And really it's about helping them get their word out also.
What mistakes did you make on the conference? Any things that you're going to be changing for future conferences?
I'd say a struggle we had obviously is getting the word out. It's like, what is this thing? What is this new 1% better conference? And it's like, okay, it's about small incremental movements forward. It's about kind of the marketing side and that piece and getting the word out. It was and it always is a difficult thing to think about. And I think the other piece was that I don't think there was enough. I wanted it even more interactive. So something I'm adding for this next conference is a panel discussion. So every 2 to 3 speakers, after they talk and then do what they need to do, then I'll facilitate a panel with them, and people can kind of talk more about, okay, what they did. And it's a Q&A, but it's also more interactive, and it's about a deeper dive into it. Because too often we go and hear something and then you just leave and it's like, that was great, but then there's no good takeaways from it. Because that's what I want. I want people to have those takeaways and thoughts on, like, how can they improve. So I was saying we added a panel discussion every 2 to 3 speakers. This next one is another change.
You mentioned having more of an intimate style, which I can appreciate. Just like, you get to talk to almost everyone, depending on the conference and how much time. I mean, I feel like 50 people is kind of the cap that, I mean, I can't even talk to 50 whole people over a weekend. It's just a little bit draining overall. I can come close, but yeah, what's the max capacity that you envision for future conferences?
I would say that's probably about what we're looking for. The 50, 60 as a max for this format. Mm-hmm. We would debate if we wanted to go bigger, but then it does get, there's so many different challenges, and you have to have different breakout sessions, or I know a lot of different conferences do that. I mean, there's so many different amazing big events that I go to, and then you talk to somebody, have a great conversation, somebody you sit next to, but then you never see them again throughout the whole conference. And I really enjoyed the Camp Fi style, or the one where it's smaller enough where you can kind of reattack a topic later on or talk about it. Or we stayed like that evening at the hotel and we had board games. And I think that just added to the kind of the intimacy and the discussion. So I think that's probably, it is this current format, probably 50 is probably the, mm-hmm. the max.
How do you think about the programming and the topics for the actual content? Because I could imagine I want to have a track where it's like an arc of a story a little bit, but then if someone misses that topic and they're like, I don't really give a shit, then they're not going to enjoy a lot of the speakers. And it could be difficult if you're like piecemealing a couple things. So how do you think about that? And you do have, as you mentioned, you have your foot in the TEDx door with a lot of really diverse speakers. And then, you know, a lot of the, you know, FIRE community folks also, which is a little bit smaller, maybe more narrow topics often. There's some overlap, but yeah, how do you think about putting together the speakers?
I've used a lot of the education I've got from the TEDx about building a conference. So we do one main event every year, and we've built it back up since COVID and the in-person event. So we do it at Creighton University in a big auditorium. So there's 300 to 400 people that come to it, but we might have 8 to 12 different speakers. And we try to, just listening and learning through that, I think helped a lot about having them. Can have a deep talk, and then it can follow it up with another deep talk, maybe kind of bounce the deep and light back and forth, and or humor filled versus very emotional. So that really helped me kind of develop that. And I mean, for me, it's about the conference is about like self-awareness and critical thinking, and those two different things. Because I mean, self-awareness is that's really the key to self-improvement. And then critical thinking about knowing who I am and what I can do. And the 1% better, it's in general, what can I personally do to get a little bit better, and what can I do to make the world around me a little bit better? So it's not cut and dry, but I try to first day a little bit more internal, day two, a little bit more external, what can I do to make the world a little bit better? So really the helping with the TEDx main events has helped a lot with the development of that arc. I mean, it is a balance between the 7-course meal and a buffet. It's about kind of one thing, the palate cleanser or whatever, the beginning to end. Sometimes these talks, they can't stand alone. And that's great if you can only come to a part of it. But if you can kind of immerse yourself and talk to others. And the other piece I love about the conference is I've added a hype box. So I think everybody writes hype messages or compliments to other attendees. So everybody left last time with a stack of compliments or hype messages for themselves. So you just, every break, we say, hey, write up some compliment or hype message for somebody else. And we collected all those. So I really wanted to be a positive environment. So the first one, I loved it. It went great. And then I'm really looking forward to this next one, which will be different, a lot of different speakers. They're almost all different speakers. So that's what I love, being curious and learning from others myself. So that's what I wanted to create.
And you had the first event in February of 2026. That's right?
That's right, yeah.
It's hard to keep track of years now. We're getting old, you know? I'm like, oh, man. So
back in my day.
then you have one coming up in August of 2026 and different venues. So talk about like the plan moving forward and dates and where these are located.
So yeah, we did the first one in February. The second one is coming. It's going to be in Omaha again. So August 22nd, 23rd, we'll still be here in Omaha. And then I'm going to test it out and going down to Orlando down in February 6th and 7th. And my daughter lives down there. And so it'd be a perfect opportunity. I know there's a lot of financial independence people down there. And so we signed a contract with the Universal Stella Nova Hotel down that resort. And so I like trying different things out. It's kind of trying new things and new people. And so, yeah, with those two things lined up, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Okay. And that's good. Well, from a weather standpoint, I think Omaha in February might scare some of the folks that don't like cold weather, right?
Yeah, that was part of the decision. But hey, can we go somewhere a little bit warmer in the cold months? So we'll try out Orlando, and then pre football season is what to kind of do in the August one here before college football gets started.
Right. That makes sense too. Yeah, pretty smart. And then since it's a whole different set of speakers, because you know so many people probably in the local Omaha area. Like, was it hard to, or will it be hard to find speakers in Florida for February next year?
It's different. I've got some people I know through the financial independence community that I've been talking to about speaking down there. I reached out to some local speakers and some connections through the improv community. So some of the people that are here are helping me find that. So it's going to be different. It is obviously a little bit harder. because I don't know as many people, but I think just even people, I think, want to speak. There's a lot of different people that are great speakers out there that it's just on me about finding those people, about finding those connections. And I think that having one here in Omaha every year is key. And then trying different new locations. And I think it's going to be harder, but I think I've got the groundwork laid already.
All right. So we're wrapping up the sort of the conference information here. What's the price point? Is food included, lodging? Like, what should people expect?
For the Omaha event, it's $250 through the end of June, and then the price will go up to $300. But so it's a 2-day event, and the lunch is included for both days. Reasonable, trying to find that balance of not being too expensive and trying to be self-sustaining.
Okay. And then lodging included, or you have to get your hotel, transportation, all that normal stuff, right?
No, it's not included. We have hotels that have a discount through. So I think if you can go and grab a room for them.
Okay.
But it's at a Holiday Inn attached to a Ameristar Casino here in Omaha, Council Bluffs area.
Okay. Very cool. And yeah, I think that's a fine price point. Food's more expensive. And if you're getting stuff catered, like, it's just, it costs money, and then you have to be able to pay the expenses. Running it is a business. So, and I'm sure you're probably losing money for the first few years. I know Diana at the economy conference has great stories about how much in debt she was as she was running the conference from year to year. And it takes a while to get the groundwork laid. And now it sells out. And really an amazing conference. And I think from the standpoint of the capacity for these kind of events, it seems very high, and related community related events, because I look at like FinTalks and the FinTalks cruises with Amberly Grant, and then Kristen Knapp has Five Friends Travel. Those things sell out, or like much higher capacity, like the Alaska cruise that FinTalks just did. I think there were something like 90 people, and it was a fairly expensive cruise, and people are traveling like across the country. Pretty amazing. So huge capacity for these kind of events. And it seems like, you know, once folks get the word out, it's also a big community. So people want different things. Some people want really big events. Some people want smaller. Maybe they want more TEDx style talks. Maybe they want something a little more casual, like a campfire. So there's a lot of different ways to work within the community and all that kind of stuff. So very cool. As we're wrapping up here, I want to cover some actionable kind of post-retirement working on projects. So you have the military background, strategic thinking, and planning. So what can you share with people that could help them as they're approaching retirement, as they are retired and they're like, okay, I need to prioritize, I need to figure out what to do and not spiral out of control and get in my own head. Everyone's different, but I think you probably have some good tips for us.
Most I learned from the military, a lot of it was the keeping organized and having that plan. I think too often we don't have a plan, and we let somebody else create that plan for us, and or just inertia allows us to just fall into wherever we are. And it's life can be so difficult, and if you're not proactive. And that was really a lot of my pivoting in life has been turning from reactive to try to be more proactive. I mean, there's all the talk about the locus of control or circle of control. What is in your circle of control, and then what's in your circle of influence? And so that's where can we kind of really restart is about, okay, what's the big picture? Where do you want to get? And then what steps do I need to make to get to that point? And I think your planning is not going to be perfect. And it's always about pivoting, about learning. So I think it's the planning and then taking action. I think too often we don't take action. We just sit and watch, and we don't realize our own biases and that what held us back. We have so many different assumptions that we've had in life that we do have that we can't do that, or I can't believe they did that, or it holds us back. And I think that's something to work through. And I mean, the military is such an amazing community of people that it's kind of helps you kind of get to where you need to go. And that's what the financial independence community I've noticed, and the TEDx communities, and the finding that community of people to help you move to where you want to go, I think is the key to life. Now, you can't do everything alone. It's just finding your tribe, finding your community. I think that even if it's online or if it's in small doses or finding a local financial independence community, I think that's really what has helped me. I think many people fall in the trap of that you talked about ego and the what's the job we do and the sunk cost fallacy that you work so hard on something you do for your whole life and then it's hard to get away from it. I'm sure doctors fall in that trap all the time that it's hard for them to retire because their identity is circled around this. But I would say too often our roles that we have in life aren't always who we are inside. And I always like to talk about the what's inside you, what adjectives do you want people to describe you by? I want to be people to describe me as kind or empathetic or curious or creative. Or I think that, as opposed to I love being a dad, I love being a father, and I love being a husband and being in the military. But these roles may change in our lives, but what's inside, that's what we should focus on. And I think that's what life should be about finding that community, finding that tribe to help us move to where we want to go. And don't beat yourselves up about making mistakes. It's okay. Learn from that mistake and critical think about what happened, what was the root cause, and how can I change next time? But it's about small baby steps to get to where you want to go. And I see it like hiking. Too often the hardest paths, that's people don't take those. People take the path of least resistance and the easy path, but the hardest path might be the path to the best view. And I think that's what life's about how can you get to the best view. And don't think that it's just a one-stop shop of life. I mean, keep curious, keep trying new things, stack those talents and do different things and see what resonates with you. I mean, that's what military, just the community, the organization, the learning from the mistakes and taking action about, okay, what holds you back and what can kind of grease the wheels a little bit and make things a little easier. I think that's what we need to do in life about finding that community of people. And I think I've found it, and I'm trying to create even more of those communities of kind, curious, creative, and critical thinkers that help people get to where they want to get. I think we're all different, and we all have our own path in life, but we can all support each other on that journey.
If people want to learn more about you or connect and learn about the 1% Better Conference, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to sparkfinancialwellness.com or the 1% Better Conference.com. I think there's a couple of different ways of getting hold of us and finding more about what we do.
All right. I'll link that up in the show notes so it's easy for people to find. Thanks a lot, David. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. We're right at the start of summer, so I've been going on a couple trips, although things have shifted on my end, which I could tell you about. But David, have you done any trips or travel in the last little bit, or what do you have coming up for conferences or personal travel?
I went to Savannah recently. I spoke at Mil MoneyCon, which is a military money conference. So it was a great time to be down there. It was May, and a lot of military friends down there, and even somebody who didn't even go to the conference, somebody I knew from 25 years ago that I'm meeting up with them going down to the dock. So it was cool. Just a beautiful time down in Savannah. Saw the Forrest Gump's little bench that he had from the movie.
Oh, yeah.
The place for it, but that was a good time. I think not too much else going on this summer. Probably going to California later this year or late summer.
Cool.
Everything's pretty quiet right now.
All right. Yeah, Savannah, it's a good town. I was going to say, like, I'm very warm-natured. It's quite humid over there by the coast as well. And really, anywhere in Georgia or in the southeast, it's pretty humid. So May is a little bit, it's almost getting a little too warm for me. I mean, it was probably in the 90s, right?
It was 80s, but it was muggy. I will say that. But we did get to eat outside on, like, it was a little muggy there, I guess. But yeah, it was by the water, so it kind of it had the breeze a little bit. If you get closer, you get to the river.
Right. Yeah, beautiful town, though. But I was going to say, I would check it out between like November and February or something like that. After that, it's too warm for me. But great food down there. So many great restaurants and cool history. I mean, you could do like walking tours and ghost tours and food mm-hmm. tours and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, very cool like layout and stuff like that. Our travels shifted a little bit. So we had a couple trips planned. Our dog got sick. So she's doing a little bit better, but she's like 13 and a half. She's sleeping behind me now. So basically, I'll skip details, but we scrapped trips and we did go on a shorter trip. So we typically take road trips so that we can bring our dog. But we were like, we're going to be a couple days away. Also heading to, in this case, to the desert. We're going to head down to Tucson and check out some national parks in Arizona. And it was going to be, whatever, 100 degrees. So a little more stressful on the dog, just from a heat standpoint. We were like, we'll go to the mountains. So we went up to Leadville, which is a like 10,000 foot, or it's a town that has an elevation of about 10,000 feet. So it's awesome up there. Really fun, much cooler, probably whatever, 20, 25 degrees cooler up there than it is down here in the foothills. So really nice. And it was a lot of fun. But we're only there for 3-4 days. So we're back down here in the heat, but it's all good. It's a bummer we had some trips canceled, but it's good that we could hang out with the dog. So
yeah, that's very important to me. Yeah, our dog's 4, and we've debated, we're going down to Florida, actually, like later on Labor Day, see my daughter and in-laws, and it's going to be, it's like, do we drive, take our dog? And it's difficult a lot of times, you know, where do you stay with the dog? So we've struggled with that a little bit. It depends on how long we're going to be down there, but I see the family. So we're still debating that one. You know, flights are so expensive now, and even points are cost a lot of points to fly. So,
oh yeah,
it's harder.
And then driving, you know, you have the challenges on the road as far as like where you could stay. And then some dogs get more stressed out either in the car or at hotels. Georgie's actually pretty, she loves the car. If you drove up and she never met you before and you like open the car door, she would literally just jump in and go on a ride with you. Just any random stranger. In hotels, she's pretty good too. But generally, it's more stressful on us than it is on her, because we're trying to make sure she has like the right routine and all that stuff.
And stops, but, and make sure water and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.